Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I am Flowman11, and with me today, I have a new member of the Endurance Chat cast. Say hello, everyone, to Troasaurus. Is that how you say your name?
Yeah, sort of. Troasaurus. It's basically a nickname based on my last name.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
That's all right. Everyone's got weird names. Like, Chris is called Kiwi. Like, who wants to be Kiwi? Oh, he's going to get me back so bad for that at some point. Oh, well. Anyway, tell us a bit about yourself.
So, I'm just recently out of university, or not so recently anymore, finishing my master's in automotive engineering.
And, oh, perfect.
A lot of that stuff was specializing in or spending my time doing aerodynamic stuff.
Oh, cool.
Because that's what I want to do. Unfortunately, some interviews didn't quite work out with the experience levels, because it's like a chicken and the egg sort of thing.
Yeah.
Getting experience out of university to get the job, you need experience that's applicable. But anyway, that's really what I want to do. My master's project was not quite with racing cars, but that was working with Team Sky, with doing their helmet aerodynamics.
Oh, for, in cycling.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And how the cooling flow works through the vents and stuff. Pretty cool.
That is actually super interesting, because I'm a big Grand Tour cycling fan. I watch the Tour de France every year, and one thing I always sort of pick up on is the weird, crazy shapes that they put in the helmets, and when they got the time trial helmets or the sprinters helmets, which don't have all the vents, and wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and it was pretty important recently, because there was that World Championships in Qatar or somewhere in the Middle East, and they had pretty horrible humid conditions, and they were getting heat stroke and stuff. So it's something you got to think about.
Hmm. Awesome. It's kind of cool to think how every little tiny piece at the very top level is engineered to that sort of crazy level. So seeing as you were working with Team Sky, I'm guessing that you're in some part of the UK?
Yeah, so based in the south of England, and was in the Midlands for my time at uni. Yeah, back down south.
Cool. Have you been to any WEC events?
I was at Le Mans for the first time last year, and yeah, absolutely loved it.
Dude, I hate you so much right now. I hate you so
much. We managed to get onto the Mont Sam at the second chicane in the Ford hospitality area. And, yeah, it was just epic.
That is awesome.
We managed to, because it's basically, they rent a farmhouse along the straight and then set up a marquee right by the entry of the chicane in the braking zone. And then a short walk up the straight, there was a garden fence that we could sit on top of that's right above the Armco.
Oh. And
so even like when they're, the P2s, they spit flames on the downshifts, and it's like you could feel the little bursts of heat and like little bits of unburnt fuel hitting your legs. It's like old footage of rallying, you know, when everyone's leaning on the garden wall.
Or like lying next to the track.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's just something I'll never forget. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
So that was there from like 8 o'clock at night. Just at twilight, and then we stayed there until 2 a.m. when they closed.
So you would have been able to see, like, the brake disc glowing, the exhaust fumes.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that sounds amazing.
And we watched both Toyotas go out right in front of our eyes in short, quick succession, which was amazing because there were probably about 30 people there, and because the fans can't get along the Mole Sand, so no one knew about it,
but you guys did.
Yeah, it was really cool, like, to see the oil fire on the second one as it came through, and it just straight lined the chicane on fire. And yeah, it was absolutely crazy.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm so jealous. Damn it.
So why
isn't there a WC
event again?
Why isn't there a WC event in Australia already? Oh, damn, that sounds so cool.
Soon.
Soon, hopefully. And we'll talk about that later, not today, but probably in a year or two, because I have an idea. Anyway, we should actually talk about all the racing that we have had over the past few weeks, because since the prologue and since what was our last episode was talking about Sebring and the WEC prologue, and now how we've moved into the first round of the ELMS and the IMSA race at Long Beach, and now we're only 2 weeks away from the first round of the WEC. It's all come along so quickly, hasn't it?
Yeah. So quick from the prologue straight away into ELMS. There were four trips around the world done at Paul Ricard in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, between the ELMS race, the ELMS prologue, and the WEC prologue, yeah, they said four
and
laps
Michelin
around the world.
Cup, yeah.
Oh, and crazy. Of course, yeah, the Michelin Le Mans Cup as well. So it has been a crazy few weeks, and we're going to crack straight into it. Talking about the ELMS, they had their opening round at Paul Ricard the week after the test, so everyone should have been able to sort themselves out following the prologue. But the first thing that struck me when I was rewatching the ELMS, just this last weekend was, holy crap, that series has so many prototype cars now. So many.
It's stacked. Absolutely stacked. And the driving talent as well is getting better and better.
And it's just like, it's not even a thing anymore. They had 19 P2 cars. 19!
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that there was 19 P2 cars made.
That's what COSCAP does.
Exactly. It just brings all these teams into the same competition. And not only that, you add to that 18 LMP3 cars. So you had 37 prototypes on track at once in the same race. Like,
it's pretty messy.
You could put that on any track in the world and it would be a great race. And we did get a great race. And then to add to that as well, 8 GT cars, it was just, there was action literally everywhere throughout the entire race. You just didn't know where to look. The commentators didn't know where to look. I struggled to actually follow the race for a lot of it.
Yeah. There was always something to watch. Mm. Always something going on. And right from the start, it was really good.
Yeah, and we saw the teams that were strong at the start, for example, Dragon Speed, and for a period there, SMP as well. They sort of fell off towards the end, and both of them in quite dramatic fashion, I would say. So the Dragon Speed car was in the lead for most of the first stint, and then suffered a puncture just before it was going to almost maybe think about coming in. So they had to adjust their strategy, but the second reason that they fell down the order, it was a bit of a weird one. Everyone's favorite bronze rated LMP1 driver, Heinrich Hedman, actually had quite a heavy contact with, was it Matt Griffin in the Spirit of Race Ferrari, yeah. And sent both cars into the barrier at the exit of Sane Corner, which is, I mean, it is one of the faster corners on the track, and it's after the Mistral, but really, you shouldn't be making contact there, especially if you're up against the lower class car. No other cars, I don't think, during the race actually made contact there, unless they were fighting for position.
Yeah, the LMP3 cars, they've got a similar top speed, only 3 or 4 kph difference between GTE and LMP3, but because of the aero differences, they can carry speed through seams a lot faster. So if they can't catch up and they're right on the back bumper of a GT car, they've got to make sure that they're not on the same line, because they're gonna have a coming together.
Yeah, they'll be straight in the back.
But yeah, the Nico Lapierre, I think, was the person in the Dragon Speed to start it off.
Yeah,
and he was just pulling away. But you know, to finish first you've got to finish. It doesn't matter how good your best driver is. If your other driver, not necessarily his fault, but can't get it home.
Yeah, and we didn't actually really get a chance to see what sort of happened with that accident either. It was just a kind of bit of, they only caught the very tail end of it, so there was a bit of conjecture over what happened, and all it really looked like, all we really saw at the end were the two involved cars shooting off well after the corner exit, to be honest, and all the way into the barriers. And to get to the barriers at Paul Ricard, you know you must be going pretty quick, because there's a lot of room.
Yeah, and we saw the tire marks and the damage on each car in terms of where contact was. So I think it was the Dragon Speed going along the inside of the corner as a right-hander and hitting the right-hand side of the Ferrari on the inside. And from the interviews at the race, Henrik Hedman was saying that he was going for a gap, and basically it sounded to me like he was assuming that the Ferrari driver had seen him, rather than assuming that the Ferrari is taking the racing line and then you negotiating around them because you've got a car with more grip.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And
so basically he was running on an assumption, you could argue that that was maybe not the best thing to do.
And yeah, it only takes one split-second moment like that to put a car out of the race. And as you said, first you have to finish. And I wonder, like, we have had this discussion before about a bronze driver making their way into LMP1 and the potential safety issues that brings into it. And I wonder if this is just the starting point of maybe us seeing the cracks around that idea, if that makes sense. Maybe if you're in a higher-powered car with more downforce and more speed, these sort of issues could become more problematic. But the thing is, Hedman is experienced, and it's not like he does this very often. And like even the best P1 drivers make this mistake as well. I mean, you only have to look back, 2 years ago, where Brendan Hartley ended up on his roof at Silverstone, and then and then you know, a few rounds later, Michael Ebert punted off Abdulaziz Al-Faisal in the Nürburgring, and then like last year, Gustavo Yakerman Rusinov got into the side of the Proton car in the Porsche curve. So it's like this isn't all that uncommon, but it's just a matter of how safe is this.
Yeah, and you can argue, despite the huge grid, and how busy the track was, he didn't have necessarily much after class coming behind him, so he didn't have to concentrate on a P1 behind him like he might have had in the past, just other cars, much quicker drivers in P2s driving up behind him. So you could argue that there are arguments for this ELMS round that it may have been slightly easier on the drivers compared to driving P2 in a wet race.
Yeah, this is true. In saying that, though, that was really the only notable incident between two cars of different classes throughout the 4 hours. I think there was maybe one other incident where the DKR engineering car got tagged going into the last corner? And
it was a P2 trying to get around a P3.
Yeah, it was very early on the race as well.
It didn't quite make it. Was it a G-drive? I can't quite remember. Cut across, I think, an MP3, and it just spun out.
Yeah, and ended up putting it in the wall, which wasn't obviously the best situation. But to have, 45 cars on track and only two major incidents between different classes, I think that's a big tick in the box for the driving quality in the European Le Mans Series at the moment.
Completely agree, yeah.
So we should talk about the results. The race engineering team actually took the maiden win of the year, followed by the TDS team, which is racing in the WEC this season. And Duquesne Engineering, stepping up from LMP3 into LMP2, took out the last place on the podium, which I think is actually a pretty great achievement for their first race in LMP3. Coming from LMP3. And that car had Pierre Rags, Nicolas Jamin, which I think is the bronze driver in that car, and Nelson Panciatici. So big feather in the cap for them. But as far as the top of the tables go, the top four cars are only separated by 12 seconds. And after a 4-hour race, that's a pretty tight gap, and it just shows, the competitiveness in the series.
Yeah, really competitive field, especially for the Orica 07s. If you look at the top times, based on drivers, all top 10 fastest times per driver, or going by driver, are all Orica 07s.
Do you think that has something to do with the Mistral Straight?
Yeah, so the top speeds in KPH aren't actually that too dissimilar between Ligier's, Orica and Alpine and Dallara. They're all pretty representative. We did see the IDEX sport car that was pretty, it looked slower in the race, as if it had set higher wing angle. And there was another team that changed the wing angle during the race in a pit stop. So maybe they had set it up for qualifying, maybe a bit more in the first and last sector of the track. And yep. then they just couldn't hold off faster cars on the massive straight.
Because that's a very delicate balancing act, isn't it? Because especially at somewhere like Paul Ricard, you have a kind of downforce heavy first few corners, a really long straight in the middle, and then the last sector is all like long loaded corners where you need that sort of downforce. So getting that balance between the enough downforce to get through the corners quickly and enough straight line speed to be able to maintain your position and to make passes, it's a really delicate balance.
Yeah, and like I was saying, the all the top speeds are pretty similar, regardless of chassis. And also, lap times, regardless of tyre choice. Michelin on the podium with their entry to P2 in ALMS. That's a good omen for the rest of the season.
Oh yeah, of course. I didn't even pick that up. The fact that this is the first race that Michelin have actually jumped into P2 in at all, I think. Because normally
they were running Dunlops last year.
Sorry, not at all. Because of course, I remember a race 2 or 3 years ago in Shanghai that was in the wet, where Alex Brundle just destroyed everyone on Michelin's. But yeah, the tire of choice has always tended to be the Dunlops in P2. So yeah, really interesting. Good pickup on that one. The top Ligier that did finish was the Panis Barthez competition car in 8th position, and everyone ahead of that was all Orica's. We did see some level of fight from the Dallara as well, with SMP Racing in the hunt right up until the end when they had to retire the car with some sort of issue. Do you think the three chassis are at parity yet, or is the Orica still the one to have?
Well, the Orica is the one to have. But throughout the race, we saw the Dallara right in the fight. And I think the Panis Barthez Ligier was fourth or fifth for quite some time. So they weren't falling away straight away from the start. It might not be representative across the whole season. We'll just have to wait and see how they handle at different tracks. But yeah, you could argue there's still a bit of extra performance out there in the Orica's.
Yeah. Well, I do hope that we do see some more parity, because I do love having the three different types of chassis on the grid, and it just makes for some just a great spectacle to have the different shapes, different colours and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, just to round that out, Race Engineering took the win, TDS Racing second, Duquesne Engineering third. Other notable names, G-Drive took fourth, and then Alpine with André Nogal and Pierre Thirier stepping over to Alpine took home fifth. United Autosports were home in ninth and in 12th with their two cars. And then, yeah, SMP Racing and Dragon Speed, the two big names to not make it to the finish. Just want to talk about GTE and the ELMS as well. This was the debut of the new Porsche 911 RSR in the AM class of any sort of series, and they brought four of them along. They had one, two for Proton, one for EBI Motors, and another one for the golf racing team of Mike Rainwright. And they were up against four Ferraris as well. And it looked like throughout the entire race that the Porsches were going to be the car to beat. I mean, especially early on in the race, golf racing, and it pains me to do this, but I should swallow my pride and say this. Mike Rainwright actually put in a fantastic first stint, to put that car in a great position for Ben Barker to take it into the battle for the lead. and they were in the box seat until the car shut down on them halfway around the lap, and they couldn't get it restarted, and they had to retire the car, which was a big shame for them, especially from an Australian perspective, because Alex Davison, an Australian Porsche driver, was due to get into that car last. So that was a big shame for me, not being able to see Alex Davison get in the car. But the eventual winners, JMW Motorsport, it was a bit of a surprise, because the Proton competition car of Rota Jr. and Cairoli had control of the race throughout the entire thing, and then come the last lap, it was chaos.
Completely, yeah. You could argue, I think the commentary team were saying that Cairoli was suffering from some illness in the days leading up, so he wasn't on perfect form. But what a crazy last lap.
And the best part about it was that the leaders finished their last lap immediately behind this battle. So they had to do another lap again. It was shades of Sebring in 2010 or Laguna Seca in the year that the Porsche and the Corvette got into each other. It was like, oh, sweet, we get one entire lap to focus on this GT battle for the lead, for the win. And it really delivered, because it was just completely out of left field.
Yeah, I've never seen a car re-enter the track at such speed and such proximity to the bumper, swerving all the way across the track.
And Cairoli looked a bit aggrieved at that point as well, because they got balked by some slow LMP3 cars coming onto the Mistral straight, because in that low rev range, the GT cars seem, especially at the hands of a professional, seem to really get the power down a lot quicker. So there was a bit of contact. Cairoli got balked, and then all of a sudden it was Molina in the JMW Motorsport car made a bit of contact and got through, and so Cairoli's just gone straight off the track and like cut a good 200-250 meters out of the corner to get onto the Mistral straight, and he definitely looked like he was not happy with what had happened.
Definitely. And then near the end of the track, just straight lining the right hander, taking a big cut out of the corner, out of the course. And I think, yeah, Graham Goodwin was right commentating, saying that it was he's a very angry man in that cockpit.
just a lot. But yeah, it was a cracking way to finish the race. And at the end of it all, it was less than a second between the two after 4 hours of racing. So even though the GTE class in ELMS is a little short on entries, it is full of talent and full of competition. And I hope that we see that same level throughout the season, because if we do, that's going to be awesome.
100%.
So last year when we had the new DPI formula in IMSA and the level of GTLM battles and GTD in IMSA, we were saying that that would be the season to watch. Do you think that ELMS might be the season to watch this year?
There's serious depth in this field. We're going to see battles all the way from P2, P3, GT. Yeah. Taking these cars, taking this field to some of the best tracks in the world, all around Europe, it's going to be entertainment, surely.
To say the least. I would keep my eye on ELMS more than I would at IMSA at the moment. Even with Yost and Penske, the new Acuras, the BMW team in GTLM, along with Corvette, and the craziness in GTD, I still think the fact that we have 37 prototype cars on track at the same time is going to just be a spectacle in and of itself. So keep your eyes on ELMS. If you've never watched ELMS before, this is the perfect race to start, because it was madness. It was the best kind of madness.
It's a good place to start as well, to have a look at up-and-coming drivers, because LMP3 is a building ground for future talent, and some of these youngsters, like the driver who set the fastest lap in P3, Job van Aertsoot, if you get watching now, you'll get used to these names, and they'll start coming through in the future.
And we've already seen teams, as we said, Duquesne graduate from LMP3 into LMP2 and go straight onto the podium. So, yeah, as you said, it's a great building block. It's almost as if it's a sports car feeder series. Who could have thought of that?
Wow.
Just another quick note. One name, if you're looking at the results list, that might be a bit of a surprise to people. In 15th place in LMP2 is a name, Newey. That is, in fact, Adrian Newey's son, I believe. I can't remember his first name at the top of my head, but he was actually quite competitive as well.
Yeah, he had a great portion of the race. I think it was him that had some debris stuck to the front of his car.
Yeah, that was right.
Just kept going and, yeah, kept on trucking around. I think he even was the fastest driver in qualifying for that car. Someone to look at, definitely.
Cool. We'll move across the Atlantic, and we'll talk about the IMSA race in Long Beach now. And there was a few changes from this race from this year compared to last year. So firstly, we only had the two classes on track this year. We only had prototype, so DPI and LMP2, and GTLM. So there's no GTT this year, which meant that the field size, instead of being 40, was 20, and instead of having amateur cars on this track, we had all professionals, which I think was a great choice, because we got way less full course yellow, way less clutter throughout the passing lapped cars and all that sort of stuff, and great racing in both classes, and only one lap between the classes at the end. So definitely much better than having an hour and 40 minutes of full course yellow as cars just crash into each other because there's no space. What did you think of having just the two classes?
Completely agree. I don't have the... I hadn't watched live last year's event, so I didn't know the contrast when I was watching it between the number of classes on track. But it felt balanced in terms of track width, size, length compared to the field. But looking at the results list coming from ELMS to this, it is quite empty.
I guess it was a good race, and I guess that's sort of the price you have to pay for this sort of track, I guess, because I feel like Long Beach is becoming more and more like the IndyCar version of Monaco, where you kind of only race on it because you have that history there and not because it's necessarily a race that's conducive to great racing anymore. Not saying that Long Beach doesn't produce great racing, because as we saw, there was some great racing, but having too many cars on this track just spells disaster. And yeah, if you had seen last year, it was a disaster. It was just a joke, and it came up in our joke awards at the end of the season for just the dumbest race that we had in the entire year. Whereas this race was actually quite enjoyable to watch, and a lot of that came from the GTE battles on track. We had the entire class separated by 3 or 4 seconds at some point.
Yeah, it was super bunched up, even up to the end. So you could argue some of that was based on strategy and making it hard to overtake. There was Sims in the
BMW,
I think, and he was holding up all of the field bar one and letting the 911 go up the road, but behind him, running up and right up until his unfortunate crash, there was just pretty much the whole field all together, right bumper to bumper, going too wide through each corner. And that's what we want to see. It's good fun.
And I got to say, the helicopter shots of the track and the way that the cameras are positioned really do make that spectacle a lot bigger. And as you said, Sims, after an early pit stop, was really kind of the cork in the bottle. And then once that cork got released, it didn't end well for Sims, did it?
No, unfortunately, offline, the grip levels and on the day weren't that high, and even online on the racing line, the number 10, it was number 10, the Cadillac locked up the rear tyres in the braking zones and had to have big saves, big moments. Offline, very difficult. It's like pulling a rope, pulling you towards the wall. And that may have been what caused the suspension damage to the 911, and definitely very visible damage to Sims's car.
And he wasn't even offline by much. It was just a car width and a half outside in the corner coming into the parking area. But you could just see the difference in the rubber of the actual laid down rubber of the racing line and then the marbles that far out. And he took the corner almost as he normally would. And that's probably what sold him into the wall, because getting on those marbles out of the tram lines and the understeer of the car would just send you, as you said, like a rope pulling you straight to the scene of the accident. And it was unfortunate for him because he'd done a great job up to that point, but it's just one of those things. And I don't think Sims has actually raced at Long Beach before. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not so sure, but that might explain it, because he starts off on the outside of the corner on the racing line, in the braking zone, turning where the grip is, and then he can't get to the apex because there's a car in the way. And so being a car's width offline then at apex, he can't sustain the speed and steering angle that he started the corner with.
Yeah.
And maybe he wasn't expecting that significant drop in grip mid-corner.
I was wrong. It wasn't Sims who hasn't been here before, it was DeFilippi. And DeFilippi had not been here before, because while he was driving with Land last year, Land didn't compete in the full season. So we got there in the end, everyone. But yeah, it was still, you know, pretty fresh in terms of the weekend as well, because that was on the Saturday, and the main race for the IndyCar on that weekend is like the last event on Sunday. So there's still plenty of rubber that gets put down over the course of the weekend. So if you do get out of those tram lines, yeah.
Sorry to cut you off again. But yeah, I did note down during the race how many support series are there, sort of thing, before this race, because this was like a support series for the IndyCar, whereas at other events there would be lots of running prior to the start of the race. So if this is one of the support races sort of thing, and there's not much running beforehand, putting rubber on the track surface, then yeah, that's something that then the drivers might not be used to.
Definitely. Other stories in the GT class. It was another win on Long Beach soil for the Corvette crew, after they won last year, I think. I'm just going to double check that again, because I have a habit of using my kind of vague memory to carry me through, and then I get called out on it afterwards. Yes, they did win last year. It was the same team as well. But there is an argument to be made that of the teams that were there over the weekend, the team that should have won would have been Porsche. But both cars suffered drama. There was, as you said, suspension damage for the 911 car, and a more significant problem for the 912, which resulted in it being parked from the lead of the race.
Yeah, horrible, horrible to see. They've put in so much hard work.
And
right up there at the head of the field.
And the thing is, it's a story that we've been saying far too much with the Porsche GT side of things in the past 12 months. Like, we said this at Sebring last year when Patrick Pile suffered a puncture and then ran over a pit hose and earned a penalty. We said this at Fuji where the Porsches in the wet should have monstered the field, and they missed their opportunity because a Ferrari had fought back into it and they didn't defend well enough, And then the red flag hit. We've said this at other events as well, where we just haven't seen Porsche grasp that opportunity yet. And at Watkins Glen as well is another thing. So it's just like, we've said this far too much, and I'm a big Porsche fan. I want to be saying Porsche wins everything again and again and again and again and again.
The tough thing about this is if the BOP is measured on just lap times rather than finishing positions, the Porsches had really good pace throughout the race and they had no reward from it. So then coming up onto the next race, if they have BOP changing because they were so quick and they were running away with the race, then they've got nothing to get out of that good pace earlier on.
Yep. And IMSA we have seen is a bit more, do we want to say active with their BOP changes? They seem to make more drastic changes more often. You know, except that one season, the WEC, where we had 9 changes for 8 races, which was a bit dumb. Yeah. But on the whole, you've got to say the BOP, at least from a spectator perspective, was on point, because as we said before, we had all these battles in GTE and it looked like anyone could have taken home the victory.
Yeah, super tight battles. It was all to play for from that last full caution.
Yeah. Would you say the same about DPI? Would you say the same? Would you say that the BOP between the DPI cars and the international cars, of which there were four in the race, would you say that that balance is as good, or is the balance between the DPI cars better than it is between the DPI versus LMP2 cars?
Well, based on the finishing order, four of the top five finishers are all different chassis. So it's not a Cadillac 1-2-3. It's a Cadillac 1-3. But regardless, it's still good to see all of the different DPI names up there at the front of the race. 6 seconds, 6.7 seconds down to 4. And that's covering, 10 seconds covering all of the DPI manufacturers. So you could argue it's getting there, yeah.
Mm. I actually think the DPI balance within DPI is actually quite good at the moment, but I'm not sure if it's the balance between the DPIs and the international spec is off, or just the fact that the international spec cars seem to have more of the amateur type drivers because they've either stepped up from PC or they've brought in people from overseas. But it just seems that at the moment that maybe it's also the track, because Long Beach is very much a sort of acceleration, you know, punching out of slow corners sort of track, which something like the Cadillac does very well at. But yeah, it seems that the international cars lack pace against the DPIs at the moment. And, yeah, as I said, that could be track-specific, that could be driver-specific, or that could be BOP-specific. But regardless, we still had quite an interesting battle up at the top of the field, which was dominated in the first stint by the number 31 car, which ended up finishing in 7th place, which was a bit of a weird one there. But the winners of the race were the sister car in Action Express, the number 5 car of Felipe Albuquerque and Joao Barbosa, leading home the Tequila Patron ESM car of Scott Sharp and Ryan DL. And then third place, the Wayne Taylor Racing, Renger van der Zander and Jordan Taylor car. One thing that I am surprised about, though, is that the Acuras of Penske didn't really make a run at the top cars. They were in position for a lot of the race, but they didn't seem to be there at the end, and I was so confused as to why. Did you have any idea?
Yeah, the Montoya's pulled that, you'd expect, based on this track not being so good with overtaking, that they would not necessarily run away with it, but they could at least hold their own.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. The lap times were there. for the Acuras. Maybe it's a consistency thing. Maybe it's the chassis getting the new tyres at the start of the pit stop in a good operating window. Yeah, it's tough to say.
Yeah, because if you look at the top times over the course of the race, the top three cars are Felipe Massa in the Cadillac that disappeared halfway through the race, and then Montoya and Castroneves, and then a few tenths back to the next car, which was actually the Yost Mazda of Tristan Nunez, I believe. So I wonder if they got caught out by that last full course yellow. I wonder if that actually plucked them out of position, or they were slow to react to that and off the start line perhaps, and dropped down the grid, because I honestly can't work it out where they lost their positions. It baffles me.
Yeah, it's a shame because they have pace. Maybe that's a BOP thing, that they've got less ballast, more boost, something like that. But yeah, pace was there, and they just didn't make the most of it.
Was a real confuddling thing. So, in your opinion, what do you think of having this shorter race at Long Beach? Do you think it's something that should stick around?
Yeah, it's tough because it's a sprint race coming straight off of having a 24 and a 12. And the practice sessions each were longer than the race duration. So it's a bit awkward coming off only a couple of weeks after such a long race, especially for the strategy and everything, because it was only one pit stop generally.
You could make it home on one pit stop, yes.
Yeah, it was just a one stop race. Maybe it's, yeah, I don't want to say that they're marketing to different crowds with sprint racing and endurance racing, because it felt like it didn't quite make it compared to looking at what we're watching Sebring and Daytona.
Yeah, I think I agree with you in the fact that it's a very odd race to have straight off the back of the two longest races of the season. But as everyone would know, it's a support event for the IndyCar, and they're not going to move that race because that has the date equity to go with it, and so it's always around this point of the season. So it's certainly a different challenge. But I think if you had too much of a longer race at this track, it would start to cause more problems than it would solve because of the nature of the track. I would make one change, though, going on to next year. While it was great that we had a lot of pro drivers here in a small field, and it meant that the race was, you know, very sort of punchy and without a lot of clutter, what it did mean was that there was only one lap separating the prototypes and the GT cars come the end of the race. So we didn't really get the classic sports car thing of, you know, passing slower class cars and all the confuddlement that comes with that. So
exactly.
So I would prefer, and I'm probably going to eat my words come 12 months' time, I would prefer if they had the GTD class here with the prototypes instead of just the GTLM class. Because at least in that aspect, you get the sports car thing of having to pass slower traffic and, you know, the ebb and flow of that sort of race. But, of course, with that, you sacrifice a little bit of quality and possibly a lot more green flag. So that would be my suggestion. I still enjoyed the race, definitely, but it did feel a bit like an F1 race, like two F1 races.
It would be interesting if you try and imagine the race, but then implementing like a code 60 scenario or virtual safety car. So Kreventic last weekend used this, and VLN on the Nordschleife. If you have a slow zone, or if you need a safety car across the whole lap sort of thing, apply a speed limit as if imagining all of the cars are on their pit lane speed limiter, how that would affect the outcome of the race, because then you wouldn't get this bunching up. And then you could argue that the race is then decided on pure pace rather than missing the jump on the bunching of the field.
And that's something that we see a lot more in Europe, and that I think IMSA especially still hasn't quite picked up on the benefits of it. And of course, they're a different organization. They run their races a different way. And the safety car full course yellow procedure is a integral part of the racing culture, I think, in America. And so, you know, the fact that they have the pits open for DP and then for GT on consecutive laps under safety car, and that means the safety car period goes on for longer and you bunch up the field, you have the wave around, etc., etc., etc. That's all things that play into the strategy of American sports car racing, which we don't see over in the European competitions like Creventic, like IGTO, like WEC and the ELMS. So if there was a slow zone sort of thing, or a full course, like a virtual safety car full course yellow type deal in IMSA, at least for maybe this race, that would actually be a big positive in making the race flow a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. It would be interesting to see what would happen. Yeah.
That's awesome, actually. That's a really good idea. And that would probably mean that you don't have 10 GTD cars crashing into each other at the first corner every single restart. So success.
Yellow breed yellows.
Yeah, exactly. So now that we've caught up on all the racing that has happened, we should look ahead to only 2 weekends away for the racing that will be happening. And we'll be talking about, of course, the first round of the WEC season, the super season at Spa-Francorchamps. And by golly, I'm getting more and more excited the closer and closer it gets. The only problem, of course, is I'm going to be working that night. God damn it.
Oh, no.
It's the worst. But still, I'm still like in hype overdrive over here, and we're still 2 weeks away. This is madness. This is a bit of a unique situation as well, at least for the WEC in the past few seasons, because we haven't had the first round at Spa we haven't had the first round at Spa at all in recent times. The only other time that we've had one round before Le Mans was it in 2009 in the old International Le Mans Cup, where we had Monza and then Le Mans. I think that's correct.
I'm not so sure. Yeah.
But either way, we only have Spa-Francorchamps and then Le Mans test day, and then you're into Le Mans, the biggest race of the year. So it's a very important practice for not only the established teams like Toyota and like Rebellion and all those sort of guys, but the teams that are stepping into the series and the, you know, looking at downforce options or high downforce versus low downforce kits, or the amateur teams in GTM or LMP2 stepping in for the first time. It's a very important dress rehearsal for them for Le Mans. And yeah, as I said, this is the first time we've really had this, because it's the first time that the super season's happened as it is. And I wonder what sort of things we get thrown out at us.
It'll be interesting to see what the Rebellions can do in their first race. They've only pretty much had a shakedown test at the Prologue. They did well, but relatively untested compared to other teams. FMP have done a lot of private testing, Toyota, a lot of private testing. So yeah, it will be interesting to see what their real true pace is, and the real true pace of the Toyotas as well.
And
we
I
don't
think,
really know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the only sort of indication, and we'll only get an indication as well, but that's going to be the only sort of information we get out of LMP1 at the end of it. It's a sort of, here's a more correct indication of every team's true pace. Because, of course, we know that Toyota over, basically broke all the regulations in setting all of their fast laps at the beginning of the prologue test. So the lap times that we have there aren't necessarily representative of their actual pace. And it looks like the actual pace is more right in the hotbed of SMP Racing and, Bike Hollows and Rebellion and of Manor. So we could be in for, I mean, fingers crossed, we could be in for a cracking race in LMP1, and I hope we are. But it just, even looking at the quality of the privateer teams, just looking at the drivers, like in the Rebellion cars, you have Neil Jani, Andre Lotterer, Bruno Senna, Matthias Besch, Thomas Laurent, and Gustavo Menezes. Like, that's a factory team. A factory team would be envious at that lineup.
It is effectively like a copy paste of a factory, big budget, OEM back driver lineup.
It's a factory dream team.
Exactly.
And you're putting them against the likes of, you know, Mike Conway, Kamui Kobayashi, Jose Maria Lopez, Sebastian Buemi, Kazuki Nakajima, and Fernando Alonso. It was Fernando Alonso's first WEC event, let's not forget. And I'm sure we won't be forgetting that. So it's the names that we have here in this P1 class are going to be ridiculous. And that's only two of the teams we've talked about. We haven't talked about SMP, we haven't talked about Manor, and hopefully we'll be actually able to talk about the revival of the Bike Hollows car.
Yeah, for the first chassis of the Bike Hollows team.
Because that car
hasn't... I wonder how many drivers they've got lined up for the second car.
Are they actually talking about bringing a second car in?
Post Le Mans, is it? Or is it the... I've seen talks of a second car post Le Mans.
So we could actually have 11 P1 cars. Oh, I need to go to lie down. I need to go to lie down. This is getting too much.
Take a breather.
Yeah. Woof. So yeah, it's yeah. What do we expect? What do we expect?
Well, it's interesting to see the different aero kits on the entry list, the spotter's guide, which are based around what we've seen running at the prologue. It'll be interesting to see if they use this as like an extra Le Mans test day for the teams with running low drag, which looks like SMP, Toyota, and Bike Hollows, giving extra running time, getting ready for Le Mans. What will be interesting is if the teams that look like they're running more higher downforce setup will be able to have the resources to implement a new aero kit in between Spa and Le Mans.
Okay, so you picked out Bike Hollows, Toyota, and SMP Racing as having a low downforce kit based on the spotter's guide. So you said that you've, you know, doing your masters in aerodynamics, sort of physics. What indicators are there on the spotter's guide to tell you that these guys are running low downforce?
So, to look at it quickly, is just focusing on the front splitters of all the cars. If you zoom in, the front splitter extension from the light pods on the cars that I've listed as low drag, low downforce, is very small. And then if you extend that across the front, in 2D, looking top down, then there's a lot lower top area for the high pressure in front of the car to act on. So that's where the downforce, some of the front downforce for the high downforce kit comes from, looking at the other cars. The splitters extend much further than the end of the light pods.
Okay, so that kind of void area over the splitter is the place where the high pressure system is pushing, well, the high pressure area is pushing down on the car. So the lack of that indicates that they're running less drag and looking for more straight line speed.
Yeah, and then when we get the to see the cars for the first time at the track, then we can also look at stuff like the rear wing and how big the and how high the angle of attack is, because the rear wings change. It's like looking at F1 at Monza. They have special rear wings,
yep,
which are much shorter.
Yep. Cool. That's really, really interesting. And what is also really, really interesting is the sheer difference, just looking at the BR1 engineering car of the Dragon Speed car versus the SMP on the Spotter's Guide. There's a massive difference just in the front end. And I'm astounded that if they've got two kits that drastically different set up already, ready to go. Like, that's a remarkable effort from BR1.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I said ages ago when on the subreddit when the SMP car with the low drag spec was spied, looking like what we'd seen on the Racing Team Nederland car at Le Mans. That Dallara had the highest top speeds in the speed trap, regardless of class, because of the lifting coast and the
hybrid one class, yep.
So I'm not surprised that they based their low drag aero kit on that. There are a few little tweaks, changing where the brake the front brake cooling ducts located. Obviously the lights have changed, and then just little changes to dive planes because of the front downforce issues that the Dallara P2 car had at Le Mans. It'll be interesting to see how much more downforce they add on to this low drag starting start point, and if we'll see a removal of these front removal of front devices like dive planes from the higher downforce spec cars, like we saw at the Prologue. Because of the straight is representative of the Mulsan, we've seen the Ginetta running with no dive planes to on a high downforce spec to maybe get a sort of hybrid meet in the middle compromise to try and find some top speed. Also, there were some interesting setups on P2 cars with a little gurney flap on the rear wing that wasn't fully across the whole span. Interesting different changes to set up. So it'll be interesting to see what different cars, different teams choose. Because like we said about Paul Ricard being a balance between high speed and long aero-dependent corners, Barr has a similar thing. So we might see some cars making gains like the SMP on the straight, but then losing out necessarily on some of the other portions of the track.
Yeah, because Spa's, as you said, it's another one of those compromise circuits. I've kind of always seen it as a high downforce circuit connected by long straights. Because if you think about it, like, Eau Rouge is, you know, a modern prototype car can get through there flat with almost any configuration. But Le Com is, you know, third gear, high load, needs some downforce. No name corner, turn 10, is again, one of those corners that you can really push. You've got some downforce. Puan, the Campus S's into Stavelot, that section is entirely downforce dependent. But then, of course, to break that all up, you have the Kemmel straight, you have the entire area from Stavelot through Blanchimont down to the bus stop, and even, you know, out of Le Com, that's all like very low drag sort of area. So yeah, it's a low downforce circuit. Sorry, it's a high downforce circuit pretending to be a low downforce circuit. But of course, we always see the LMP1 cars bring their low downforce kit here as a preparation for Le Mans. So I'm a bit bemused by the decision of Dragon Speed to run a high downforce kit on the BR1. Maybe they're looking for a good result, or maybe they found that that is easier to drive, perhaps, at a circuit like this. I don't know.
maybe they've been experiencing the same problems that the P2 car had.
That's a good point.
Maybe they hadn't fixed it. They tested both high and low downforce kits at Paul Ricard, and they haven't said anything positive or negative about either, though it's only speculation at this stage.
So what you're saying is we have no idea.
Yeah, maybe the drivers are unhappy with, they're always unhappy, but maybe they're unhappy with the low drag, low downforce setup.
Hmm. Interesting. It'll be a very interesting race in LMP1, and we'll get back to predictions later on. But we'll look a little bit into LMP2 now, and for the first time, we have a grid of LMP2 cars in the WEC which aren't just Orica's. And I mean the full season entry aren't just Orica's. We have a Dallara in the Racing Team Netherlands car, and we have a Ligier in the shape and colours of the Labra competition car. And let me tell you, I did not realize that hot pink and blue and white would look so good on a car until I saw it on the Ligier. Oof. Oof.
Yeah, it looks nice.
Very pretty. And just quietly, the best thing about that car is Fernando Ruiz isn't driving. I didn't say anything. Guys, what are you talking about?
What was that?
Huh? Not nothing.
I couldn't quite hear you.
But yeah, we have a reduced field in LMP2, which we knew going in. We've got only one car from Alpine, the two cars from Yoda / Jackie Chan, return of the TDS car, and of course we've lost the Rebellion cars to LMP1, we've lost the Mana cars to LMP1, but in return, we have gained a car from Dragon Speed, featuring Roberto Gonzalez, Natalia Berton, and former Formula One driver, Pastor Maldonado. So that'll be a car to keep an eye on, if only for safety reasons.
Well, keep an eye on it for pace reasons as well, because he's quick.
And that too, but, you know, just keep an eye out. We also have, as I feel like an extra practice for Le Mans, the G-Drive car, which isn't actually a WEC full season entry, this year. Roman Rusinov, John Eric Verne, and, I believe that is, Andrea Picciottola, in that car. There was reported at the beginning of the year that they won't be running the full WEC season. They'd be running in the ELMS. But we do see them here at Spa as an extra event for them to practice for Le Mans. Which is also why we saw teams like Alpine and TDS in the ELMS race.
Makes sense.
Yep. But I'm most excited in this class for two cars. One is the Alpine car, because I'm a big fan of Pierre Thierrier, and the fact that he's in an Alpine now instead of that G-Drive car from last year is a big plus for me. The second car that I'm really interested in is one of the Jackie Chan DC cars, which is running with a full Malaysian lineup, which I think is really, really interesting, because I was interested in that car from the beginning when it was released, because it had Jasmine Jafar, who, for those who've been following Blank Pain, was a driver in the HTP Mercedes squad and was putting in some very good drives in the middle of last year and also the year before. So the fact that he's now driving in the WEC for Jackie Chan DC, and bringing along with him two other Malaysian drivers, I think is real cool.
Yeah, despite F1 pulling out of Malaysia, there's still Malaysian motorsport going strong.
Hmm. Any particular cars that you really want to keep an eye on in the LMP2 class?
I'd like to see what Guido van der Garde can do with the his first race in the Dallara of Racing Team Nederland at Spa. That will be what I'm keeping my eye on. And also in the car, if Fritz Bonnier can keep up.
Well, I mean, Fritz Van Erde and Jan Lammers, I mean, they're great, but they're both bronze, and we have seen, we saw last
old boys
year.
On tour.
Yeah, basically. Basically. Are you expecting much from them in terms of race results?
Not so much.
No.
But it's good fun.
Okay, who do you reckon is going to win this class then?
I think it's going to be between the Signatec Alpine and one of the JCDC cars. But a dark horse, potentially, Pastor Maldonado doing really well in the Dragon Speed. He came in straight, having never driven these cars before at the Prologue, and was setting some really, really quick times. So I'd be interested to see how they get on.
Okay, yeah, fair call, fair call. The only issue I have with the Jackie Chan DC cars is that they have lost some of their standout driving talent compared to last year. So, you know, Alex Brundle, Tristan Gomedy, Thomas Laurent, Oliver Jarvis, they're no longer with the team anymore. Instead, they have the aforementioned Malaysian car, Jasmine Jafar, Viron Tan, and Nabil Jeffrey, and I'm pretty sure I've messed all of them up. And then the other car, they have Hoping Tung, Gabriel Albury, and Stefan Riquelme. So, you know, not quite the Oliver Jarvis, Thomas Laurent sort of level. I'd actually be looking again towards Alpine with Thierry Nagrao and Nicolas Lapierre, but also the TDS racing car of Francois Perrotto, Matteo Lacivieri, and Loic Duval making up the third driver in that car. So I think that's probably going to be the car to take the win in that class this weekend. Well, this coming week. So yeah, that wraps up LMP2. Moving down the list to GTE Pro, and we will see this for this race, the debut, the worldwide debut of the new Aston Martin Vantage AMR, the car that's replacing the old Aston Martin Vantage, which first raced in 2009 or something like that. So it's been due for an upgrade.
Yeah, it was an old girl. Yeah.
Yeah. Also very exciting with that is the fact that we get to see Alex Lynn in a factory GT car for the first time, which I've been singing Alex Lynn's praises for a year and a half now, so I'm very happy about that. But we'll also see the debut of the BMW in Europe with Tom Schick, Katzberg, Felix da Costa, and Blomqvist behind the wheel. And yeah, all our favorite faces from Ferrari and Ford as well. So it's gonna be a cracker. It's gonna be the first time we've had 10 GTE Pro cars in a normal WC race for a while, actually.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's difficult to say any predictions for this one because most of the field is new. The cars are new, and the best time, and I'm not accusing anyone of anything here, but the best time, if you were to be a little naughty with any potential sandbagging, is with a brand new car, because you can just say, oh, it's a little heavy, or oh, the aero isn't so good, and then while doing pre-season testing, and then come up to the first race or Le Mans and just run away with it.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that happening. Just a quick sidebar. All of the cars in this class are so new that the oldest spec car in this class is the Ford GT.
Yep.
Can you believe that? We've cycled every single car in the last two seasons.
Well, you could argue that it was Ford's fault for injecting this development, because when it was brand new on the scene, it looked very different from the rest of the field in its design.
It was a race car that they built a bunch of road car copies of.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I guess you could call it Ford's fault. Another thing we can blame Ford for. God damn it, Ford, why have you done this? But on the plus side, it has really upped the level of competition, and with the new computerized BOP, it has made, especially the last half of last season from Le Mans, made GTE really enthralling to watch. And I'm not going to be brave enough to make a prediction in this class. Like, that's just almost suicide at this point. But what I do hope for, and what I am predicting, is that we will see a cracking race up the front. And the reason for that is because I trust the computer guys to know what they're doing to get these cars to be at the same level. And I trust the crews and the teams and the drivers to be able to perform at that level. So that way we get to see the best GTE battle that's ever happened. You know, yeah, until the next race.
It should be really good to watch. So long as James Calado doesn't throw toys out of the pram going down the main straight.
Because he's going too slow.
Yeah. So long as BOP creates a balanced rate, as it should, then it will be good. It's good for the sport.
Yeah.
But if not, then fair enough. There are people aren't so happy for good reason.
Yeah. Just a quick one very last thing on GTE Pro before we move on. This is also going to be the return to the series of one Gian Maria Bruni, who has been who took a forced sabbatical from the WEC after breaking his contract conditions with Ferrari and changing to drive with Porsche. So if we see Jimmy Bruni in a car, surrounded by a few prancing horses, don't be surprised if things get just a little tense.
I don't blame him, though. I mean, what a car to drive.
I know, right?
Running away to drive for Porsche.
And Porsche don't only take the best, so you know it's a big feather in your cap, right?
Exactly.
I'm not biased at all. What are you talking about? Okay, last class in the field, GTE-AM. Again, first race for the 911 RSR in GTE-AM this year. We have a massive field of 9 cars, up from 5 from last year. And we have 4 of the new 911s, 3 Ferraris, and 2 of the very old now Aston Martins. It's unfortunate that the Aston Martins weren't able to upgrade to the new car. I'm not sure. Of course, they were trying to get a waiver, but even if they had gotten the waiver to run the new car, I'm not sure that they would have been able to, because of course they would have had to build all the extra cars. So yeah, it's a bit of weird stuff there. But on the plus side, we now have 2 cars from Proton, a car stepping up from the ELMS in TF Sport and the Aston Martin. A new car from, I honestly don't know where this car is from, called Team Project One, which is driving the Porsche, and an MR racing car, which I also believe is new, which is a Japanese team running the Ferrari. So 4 new cars and, you know, new 911s, Ferraris, Aston Martins. We're going to see the same old faces in the likes of, Paul Dallalana, and Khaled Al-Kabaisi, Mike Rainwright from the Golf Car, Christian Reed, of course, and Proton, Weng Sung Mok and Kei Tasawa in the Clearwater Racing Car with Matt Griffin. Shout out to Alex Sinclair, who I'm sure is listening. And then we're also going to see a few really cool new names back in the series. Giancarlo Fisichella in the Spirit of Race Car, Jörg Bergmeister in the Team Project One car, and a driver that I am really, really excited about, Matt Campbell in the Dempsey Proton Racing Car, who Kiwi and I have been singing his praises for the past 2 seasons, and to see him finally get an opportunity in the WEC is so cool, and I hope he doesn't mess it up. Yeah, what are you most excited about in this class?
The Porsches, what a field of Porsches, the drivers. You wouldn't think that this was an AM class based on I mean, we've got, isn't Fisichella Platinum?
Yeah.
It's crazy, the depth of field. I'm looking forward to see what Bergmeister does in the new Project One car. And, yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah. Just quickly, we have 4 Platinum drivers in this class, and you could argue that some of the gold drivers that we have should be Platinum drivers anyway. So we have Giancarlo Fisichella, Jörg Bergmeister that we've already mentioned. We have Olivia Beretta in the MR Racing car, who's a Platinum. And we have, of course, Pedro Alami driving with Paul Dallalana and Matthias Lauda as a Platinum as well. So, like, damn.
Yeah, just all the way through.
Just damn. How are these guys in GTEM? Like, we were...
It's good for the sport.
It is fantastic for the sport, and I'm trying to remember the sort of feeling of, like, the general air of defeat and, like, somberness that we had, you know, 8-10 months ago when Porsche announced that they were leaving LMP1, and we were so worried and so down on the culture of the WEC. We were sure that this would be the end of WEC as we knew it, and that LMP1 would fold into itself, and, you know, we'd have to accept DPI at Le Mans because we wouldn't get anything else, and that, you know, AM competition in GT was, you know, very, very low, and there were, you know, bits and pieces of factory support in GTE Pro, but, you know, we were all so very down. And then to come to the first race of the season and have, you know, 18 cars in the prototype class, 10 of them in LMP1, and then a field of 19 GT cars, 9 of which are GTE AM cars, 4 of which feature Platinum drivers, it's the way that the series has turned around in a time that we were so doom and gloom about it, to be this excited and this up in arms, it's just, oh, I honestly can't believe it. I honestly can't believe that we're sitting here 2 weeks away so excited for a series that we were sure 6-8 months ago was going to be a flop.
Yeah, it's turned around amazingly, and it shows the draw of Le Mans, people willing to come to this sport after huge names have pulled out in the last few years. It shows there's still an attraction to this race. There's still attraction to this series. And, yeah, it's still moving forward. We're here to watch people watch cars race, and we've certainly got that.
And I'm sure that this race, it's not going to go down without some story that we didn't expect. Whether that's Manna and by Colles locking out the podium, or Labra and Team Netherlands winning in LMP2, or if it's like, I don't even know what could be more crazy than that, or something's going to happen this race where we're just going to have our minds completely blown, and I can't wait. I can't wait to have my mind blown by this race, man. It's going to be amazing.
It's going to be great.
So that's Spa-Francorchamps at WEC. So just very quickly, if you are looking to watch the WEC, and you should be, of course, otherwise why are you listening to this, really? They have released details on the streaming package for the year. I believe it is 40 or 50 euro, depending on whether or not you buy it with or without Le Mans. And you can get that worldwide, except in America, where you have to subscribe to, I think it's the Velocity Channel or Motor Trend On Demand or something, which honestly is a bit crap. But look, I'm not going to get into, you know, business politics about this, and I honestly don't even have the expertise to be talking about it right now. Anyway, buy the streaming package. If it's not good at Spa, refund it and find some other way to watch Le Mans. We have had, of course, issues last year at Le Mans. And so, look, I don't want everyone to be able to watch this race. So if you can't spend money on it, make a bit of noise about it. Anyway.
But also, looking as a devil's advocate for this, think about how many of these houses around America that have never watched these events, but they're going to get it for free because it's already part of the package that they're subscribed to.
Yeah, I'd never really considered that.
Discovery Network.
Mm.
And if this is already going to be shown in people, millions of people's households that have never seen it, if a few join the sport because of this move, going to the one of Discovery's networks, then you could argue there's a positive there, but it's not rewarding current viewers, and that's the risk they've taken.
Yeah, and I guess it's a matter of trying to make the right decision for the right market in the US. And of course, like in Australia, where I'm from, cable TV doesn't exist. We have satellite TV, or we just have, well, had decent free-to-air TV, and now we don't have that because... Anyway, exactly. But I've heard from people in America that, you know, cable TV is a thing that a lot of households have. It's pretty standard across the board. And so, yeah, we could end up with a great swing of Americans who have never seen this sport, end up with it on their TV and come and join this community and join the sports car community. And it could be brilliant. But on the flip side, it could also be horrible. We're not going to know until the end of the season when the viewing numbers come in, really. So, I mean, hey, fingers crossed. And if you're an American who has been ostracized by this decision, go complain to the WEC. We can't do anything. We're really helpless. We're just a bunch of guys talking crap, really.
Not our fault.
Not even a little bit. I mean, the talking crap part is our fault, but everything else isn't our fault.
Yep.
So yeah, that'll be 2 weekends time, April 5th, I believe. April 5th and 7th, well, 5th to 7th. Sorry, not April, what am I talking about? May 4th to 6th. So I was almost right, I was just a month off. So I wasn't almost right. Shut up. Finally, to wrap up, we're going to be talking about something that I think is really, really cool, and we should be talking about a lot more. So we're going to be talking about the 919 Hybrid Evo, the LMP not one car, the LMP zero car that Porsche have made out of the ashes of the LMP one program. That this car is ridiculous. It has now gone out to Spa-Francorchamps and taken the overall lap record at Spa-Francorchamps, faster than an F1 car. In a sports car that weighs almost a ton, is now faster than an F1 car around Spa-Francorchamps. And I think that is an outstanding achievement. However, there have been people who have said, what is the point? So are you brave enough to tackle that question, Trevorosaurus?
I mean, they've got a car lying around. It's either going to be in a museum, or they can let the engineers have some fun with it. There are some extra things they've put to the car that you could argue are road relevant, like the brake-by-wire system. I'm not complaining.
Yeah, I'm not complaining either. I think it's fantastic because, you know, Porsche, sports car, beating F1 cars. It's like the dream. But on top of that, there are a few other important morsels of information about this that really, I think, makes it a good marketing and engineering exercise as well as just a racing exercise. So they've added a few things because of course they're no longer shackled by the LMP1 regulations. It means that they can do things like active aerodynamics or active suspension or, you know, running DRS or not have to worry about fuel flow regulations and stuff like that. And so as far as I've seen or have had confirmed, all of these things are on the car. So they basically made like a dream supercar out of a LMP1 hybrid. On top of that, it's a great testbed for trialing new technologies that they wouldn't have been allowed to in the WEC. So I believe there's something in the braking system that is like brand new that's almost never been done before.
Yeah, I absolutely love what they've done.
Okay, yeah, tell us about the braking system. So I was trying to remember whether or not it was you who told me about it.
Yeah, the braking system is, it in theory, the way that I think about it, is there's a potential to have perfect braking. So, for example, regardless of attitude of the vehicle, with pitching, with rolling, if you're going into a changing radius corner where the weight transfer is different and the loads on each corner of the car are different, the car can measure, in theory, the load on each corner, which is relative to the grip levels in each corner of the car. You can then apply braking force relative to those grip levels and up to the limit of grip. So, for example, think of, let's say, the Audi Sport cutting or the hairpin at Bahrain, where it's a kink into the hairpin. So you're braking with body roll. You can then brake the outer tire harder because it's got more load, and then brake the inner tire less. So you can, the driver has confidence in the brake pedal such that they will not lock up. So you can go right up until the limit of grip and not exceed it every single time, which allows you to brake later. Also, the rules of braking, when you're learning on a racetrack, you brake in a straight line where the car's nice and stable. You're not turning in and then braking, let's say.
Yeah.
With this, it's rewriting the rules. You can throw the car into a corner and brake, and it will manage it for you. And it will do brake torque vectoring as well to help turn the car around the corner. So Neil Jarny, when he broke the record, was going at the end of the straight into the corner, into the chicane, in fifth gear, which is absolutely crazy.
What?
Just throwing the car into this corner.
That's mental.
Hoping that the brakes system will work and the computers are working. It's just stunning.
That's crazy. And even just as a engineering exercise, like I've pulled a quote here from the official press release from Stephen Mitas, the chief race engineer for the LMP1 car, who is the head of the project of this 919 Evo LMP1. The quote is, "It's kind of an engineer's dream come true." No matter how successful the 919 hybrid was, we could never show its full abilities. But now with the Evo version, we're not limited by regulations, but by resources. So they've gone as far ham as they can absolutely go with building this car to be the most ridiculous piece of machinery that anyone's ever seen. Oh my God. Like, it baffles my mind that a sports car, even a prototype sports car like this, could outdo a F1 car. The way that the cars are built and the distribution of the car's power and energy and weight are just so dissimilar that I would have never thought that it would have been possible, even in this sort of trim. So,
yeah, you let's not forget though that these F1 cars also have these fuel flow limits that are slowing them down. So you could argue imagining what an F1 car can do without these some of these restrictions that were taken off the 919.
This is
the Tribute Edition.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. I mean,
but
why do you have to spoil it like that? Why do you have to spoil it like that?
But I will also add to that, the time difference between the WEC race last year and the tribute lap was 12 seconds. That's insane. 12 second lap delta between those two cars.
That's mind boggling. Just,
And the amount of grip that this, that it threw Eau Rouge and Radial, it was 5G peak lateral acceleration.
That's like
4G vertical.
That's like a friggin', that's like aeroplane numbers.
That's an F-16, yeah.
And he's doing this in a car?
Yeah, and imagine what the tyres are, you know, the driver's screaming. Imagine what the tyres are screaming as well.
That's terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying. And I cannot wait to see what this car can do at some other tracks. It has already said that they're going to be doing an exhibition lap at the Nordschleife. And I believe that's going to be at the 24 Hours of Nürburgring weekend. So coming up in the coming month as well. And I don't know what exhibition lap means, but I hope that it doesn't end in disaster. But this...
Well, judging by its how it could just, you know, do a shakedown test at Spa and break the record, it doesn't really need to be pushing too hard.
No, that's a good point.
Set an amazing time.
Oh, that's... 12 seconds. I cannot believe that number. That's ridiculous. Anyway, yeah. Porsche have made something completely mental out of this. And as a technical, pursuit, as an engineering pursuit, and even as a marketing pursuit, they've already done the rounds with press releases and YouTube videos and all that sort of stuff. It's just a great demonstration of what the brand can do, I guess. And some may call it a waste of time. I think it's better than keeping a car like that in the museum. And I don't know. It's just, it's still mind-boggling to me that this sort of thing can be achieved. So, yeah.
Get out there and watch it.
Yeah, that's as far as my thought process sort of gets. Yeah, as I said, has active aero, has DRS, and it's just... It's just a ridiculous piece of machinery, and I can't wait to see more of it. And I think that brings us to the very end of our show. Do you have anything you want to add on anything that we've talked about today?
I don't think so. I just can't wait for the season to begin.
And neither can I. And before we finish up, I just do want to say thank you very much for joining me, Trevor, I'm going to mess that up every single time. Trevosaurus, did I get it right that
there
time?
Go.
Yay, I did it. Thank you very much for joining me. Hopefully we'll see a lot more of you in future Endurance Chat episodes. Yeah, this was really great. Thank you for especially teaching me about some aerodynamic sort of stuff.
Thanks for having me.
No problems. We will be introducing some more new faces in the Endurance Chat booth in the coming weeks and coming episodes. Hopefully we'll be looking at like maybe one or two new people per episode for coming up, which is really, really cool. And thank you for everyone who's joined in the last few weeks. I put out a call for more people to join up a few weeks ago, and we got a lot of responses, so thank you very much. And yeah, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time. As I always say, what is the worst that could happen?
You know, have like a stroke or something.
Yeah, that is actually pretty bad. don't have a stroke, please. Don't have a stroke.